Word to the Wise. We are an explicit podcast tackling content with adult themes and whatnot. This week, in this Patreon-sponsored bonus episode, we are talking about The Lies of Locke Lamora by Scott Lynch. Welcome to Words and Whiskey Short Pours-ish. You know, it's Words and Whiskey. This is Words and Whiskey. This is sort of like our monthly pod-ish format. The idea being, you know, we get to talk about other books and have a fun time discussing those fictional worlds, people that create them, all while boozing just a little bit. My name is Cross.
My name is PJ.
And we are here to talk about The Lies of Locke Lamora by Scott Lynch. I am so stoked.
We just gave up our fucking names, Cross, and the Falconer's coming for us.
Oh, fuck. Our true names. Oh, no. I didn't think about that at all. I am so excited to talk about this book. This, you know, we both finished both of these books pretty close to each other as far as like Dungeon Crawler Carl and The Lies of Locke Lamora goes. And I really wanted to talk about both of them. But we were more recent on Lies and we went back to record Dungeon Crawler Carl. So like I'm a little out of sorts in some ways, so I'm happy that you are almost through a complete reread of it already. Mm-hmm. So more details therein.
Yeah.
But cheers to Kira for sponsoring this episode.
Cheers, Kira.
All right. Sweet. Well, with that,
Oh, shit.
Did that kick you in the...
I don't think I've ever taken Smith & Cross as a shot before.
Hmm. I did the other day, and it's burny, but it's pleasant. Like, afterburn is pleasant.
The funk is really strong, though.
Yeah. Oh, for sure.
Anyway.
No, I think I did that like 3 or 4 episodes ago, whatever, like when we were talking about it after the fact. But cool. Well, I'd love for us to start talking about what we're drinking. We're both absolutely so excited to talk about this book. But first, just a quick rundown on what you're having.
First drinks. So I am having a pineapple Mai Tai. So I made a batch of it for Kaylin and her friends last night and had some extras, so I shook it all together. I don't have the recipe. It was mostly I made a large batch version of the Smuggler's Cove Mai Tai recipe, and then
added the best one in my opinion.
Yeah and then added equal parts pineapple juice to the non-liquor components is basically how I did that. So it's sweeter, but it's incredibly drinkable, great for this 91 degree Fahrenheit Minnesota summer day.
Oh god, I was texting it. Today is Mother's Day when we're recording this.
Happy Mother's Day.
My grandma, and she was like 90 degrees, and I'm coastal and it's like 70 here today. Yeah. So it is way hotter where you are.
Yeah, exactly. So awesome, refreshing, tropical pineapple Mai Tai. And then I got a I didn't look at the name of this beer before I picked it out. It is a Drekker collab with Youngblood Beer Company called Boo Caught Me Sleeping.
That's a very cool little label there. Love it. Nice.
Yep. So IPA from Drekker, always delicious. Crossland, what are you drinking?
Tasty. PJ, you know, we were taking an opportunity of time, more or less, to record this episode. And so what do I do when I have very little time? I go to an old standby. At the moment, that old standby that I am always perpetually enjoying is a Negroni. So I made the Negroni. Again, the like French style. I have the weird vermouth that you and I talked about, the like turn me on vermouth.
Yeah.
Yeah. In this Negroni. So did I make the last one with it? Maybe I did. No, I don't think I did, because I think I just bought it and told you about it. So I've yet to try it with the vermouth proper. So I'll do that real quick, but it's great, you know, classic.
So there, I did try very hard to think of a way to make a ginger scald. Okay. I just couldn't figure out how to do that with what I had available or could think of.
Yeah, fair.
It seems like a very interesting drink, though, that they have in the book.
Yeah, I definitely want to create. I have a dream that maybe someday we read the second and third books and like there's more cocktails or we come back with like a brandy-ish cocktail, because that feels absolutely like something we should have done.
Yeah,
but I don't drink a lot of brandy. We don't drink a lot of brandy on the show. So
I don't drink a lot of brandy, period.
No, I know. I mean, just in general, like, yeah, obviously. But like on top of that, like I can't remember. That's like a fully unexplored like cocktailing area, I guess,
mm-hmm,
for us. But to follow that up, I'm having a Sun Lab beer here. Pretty Little Devil. It's a hazy IPA with Citra, Incognito, Cryo, Rewaka, and Galaxy hops. This beer is delicious, PJ. It is one of the best beers that I've had in the area that reminds me the most of some of the old Minnesota breweries that we used to go to all the time. Nice. I got it yesterday. They also have a sour that I may be having later if we go a little bit extra long, or if I want something else that is sea salt, lime, guava, and it's incredible. It's diabolical. I had to choose between the two for this. So
nice.
I'm probably doing both, but we'll see.
There you go.
Yeah. So, all right. With that in mind, let's kick it off. Oh, and Sunlight, by the way, Florida Brewing Company, I think out of Clearwater. So regardless.
But all right.
What'd you think of this book?
I went through a little bit of an undulating phase with this book. In that it was a ramp up, not an undulation, just a low to high to maintaining that high on a reread.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it took a good couple. How do these chapters work? Like they're titled chapter as chapters,
chapter interlude. Yeah,
but then within each chapter there are sub chapters, so it feels like they're parts or like books, like book one, like
mm-hmm,
whatever. It took a couple sub-chapters to really kind of get into it. Maybe really took like through the prelude. Oh, what's the prologue? Like through the prologue, I was kind of not feeling it. And then it mm-hmm really ramped up like through part one. And then I was totally, totally locked in with it. And not to use the name of the book. But yeah, and then on reread, I was totally into it, like more into mm-hmm the first part than I was previously or had remembered. Like, I don't know. It grabbed me a little bit slowly and then it maintained that hold. And I really enjoyed it. I think part of it was the, like, just getting used to the audiobook narrator. I strictly listen to this book. I don't have a physical copy same of it.
Yep.
So for that reason, I'm kind of nervous to hear some or to see some of the words written and to try to pronounce some of the words without having like any sort of visual sort of understanding of how they're spelled, you know. But I don't think there's anything too terribly crazy.
No. Yeah. I would agree. I think that similarly, I also only listen to this book and I physically have the audiobook in my hand, PJ.
Yeah, I heard
did
you
want to check.
I heard you press play on it.
I did accidentally press play on it for just a second because it wasn't pulling up the chapter list. So I had to go pop, pop. But yeah, so physically here, I would agree with you. For me, it was the prologue, basically, through that section, The Boy Who Stole Too Much, that was basically what it took me to get into it. What's interesting is this was a sponsored book, of course, via our Patreon and kind of everything that we do there. But this was a book that I myself had started and kind of bounced off of with the intent of coming back to it, in part because of the narrative device that's employed in the story, not because of the perspective. And it felt like a distraction to me versus the type of story that I'm trying to write. And so I feel like I can only read in the same style, if that makes sense, or I felt that way very strongly. And I broke for these two books specifically. So I loved it though. I mean, like you said, like it, when it grabbed me, it was unrelenting. I raced through this book. I thought I was racing through it and you passed me, which is crazy. And I was like, what? What do you mean you're on chapter like 15 or 16 or whatever? And I was like, Jesus Christ, I got to finish the book.
So, I really like plowed through it. I didn't want to stop listening,
mm-hmm,
which as a benefit to that, it gave me like a week of podcast backlog to like listen through at work. So it worked out for the podcast that I listen to on a weekly basis.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was, what a good book. I think it's probably a good idea before we get into kind of the meat of this to do a little summary. You want to read that off here?
Yeah, let's do that. I pulled this from the summary in Goodreads. I don't know where they source that from or if they write it themselves.
Sometimes it's the back of books. Sometimes it's like individually applied. Sometimes it's the Amazon page. It's tough to tell.
Yeah. But it goes like this. An orphan's life is harsh and often short in the mysterious island city of Camor. But young Locke Lamora dodges death and slavery, becoming a thief under the tutelage of a gifted con artist. As leader of the band of light-fingered brothers known as the Gentlemen Bastards, Locke is soon infamous, fooling even the underworld's most feared ruler. But in the shadows lurks something, or lurks someone still more ambitious and deadly. Faced with a bloody coup that threatens to destroy everyone and everything that holds meaning in his mercenary life, Locke vows to beat the enemy at his own brutal game or die trying. That actually gives away a lot more than I would have expected. It does. I mean, it doesn't give away any actual specifics, but I feel like had I read this ahead of time, I would have had a lot more expectation for this book. Like,
yeah,
there are some very, very good. Yeah, exactly. And I don't know. The Grey King doesn't really show up until halfway through the book.
Yeah.
So, like, hard to judge how I would have felt reading this before picking up the book, but this feels like one that tips a little too on the heavy side of information given.
I would agree a little bit for sure. I feel like the thing that shocked me the most, I had such a fascinating experience reading this book. I was kind of going through it variously. I have been starting like a new workout regimen and like doing that all the time and was listening to this and then would go like meet up with my brother and friends for like beers and whatever. And like we moved a friend out and all these other things. And every time I came back, like on a different day, another character had died. And I was like, guys, I lost another one. Like, and I was just like all of these different things. And like, and then the coup happened and that was on the day of the move. And I was like, I lost everyone. Like, this was not the way I thought. And they're like, what the fuck is this book? And I'm like, it's so good. Everyone's dead.
That's really funny.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's really good.
It's a damn good experience. So yeah, I'm kind of sad that it tips that hand a little bit, but you know, it's good reads too. So it's probably not quite the same as the actual back of the book, but
I'm pretty sure I have a Goodreads account and sure. I think it's linked to my Kindle.
Okay.
So I think if anybody follows me on Goodreads, which I don't know why you would, because I've never opened the Goodreads, Goodreads webpage. I like, but if anybody does, they know what I'm reading on Kindle, maybe, kind of. But I don't actually know what Goodreads does. Like, what is the purpose of this website?
It's a review platform, mostly. So it's basically kind of like a social review platform designed to aggregate opinions. Amazon bought it like 7 or 8 years ago, I want to say.
Better since then, right? Naturally, when everything gets bought by a major corporation, things get better.
For sure. What's interesting is that it was a bad website before and it's still a bad website now. Like, functionally, it works terribly. It has not gotten better.
It's not really, like, they're the one in this space is kind of...
Pretty much. And now there are, like, more competitors popping up. But anyway, the core point here is that they wanted the information and to be able to, like, correlate that and put it on Amazon to, like, boost sales or to help, like, articulate the algorithm in different ways, because it is sort of like the reader's opinions on things, wherein something like Rotten Tomatoes is obviously like sourced opinions predominantly from, you know, authorized reviewers. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's an interesting platform. I have a really big beef with Goodreads personally. I just don't like the structure.
Beef reads.
Yeah, beef reads. We're going to be talking in Books and Baddies. We're going to be talking specifically, do a whole episode on like review ranking and Goodreads and sort of the ideas there. And I'm just kind of, I've got a big, big beef with the review culture as it stands. So
fair enough. Do authors use, or do publishers, probably the publishers more than the authors themselves, use Goodreads as like marketing material?
It is kind of a marketing arm. So like people get sent ARCs or get delivered ARCs via various services. Generally as a part of that, more often than not, they ask for a review publicly as a part of that, either in the form of like a blog sometimes or like an Instagram post or like we've done with Rob, you know, doing an interview and talking to him. Obviously, we do that regardless. You know, that was technically conditional upon our receiving the books, but like we were going to do it anyway. So, you know, things like that generally are sort of the exchange variable. Goodreads is just one of the many outlets there. So,
gotcha.
Yep.
Cool. Thanks for the tangent on Goodreads.
Relevant.
It struck me as I like looked for the summary on it. I'm like, I don't actually know what Goodreads does.
Yeah. My TLDR on my rant is I think that Goodreads has too much power to impact the sales of authors in the algorithm of Amazon itself. And so I intensely dislike it for that reason. It is very easily boughtable. and people's opinions are often shaped on these things very simply by those functions.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Makes sense.
So I love it. But that's my like TLDR. I've got more deep feelings that I will explore on a different
check day. Check out the Books and Baddies podcast outlining.
Yeah, that's going to be in the fall. So that's going to be a while, but it'll be a bit, but we'll get there. Cool. So yeah, let's start with this premise. Now that we've kind of gone through, I love this "An Orphan's Life is Harsh." There is this like element of Charles Dickens over top of the rest of this.
Yeah.
Very Oliver Twist, you know?
Yeah. And I mean, I was struck with that specifically mm-hmm. because of the name of the Orphan's Twist. And mm-hmm. I wondered if that was intentional or a nod in any way.
I've listened to a lot of Scott Lynch interviews since reading this book because I was obsessed, and I also couldn't read the next book, you know, because we need to record this episode, and I didn't want to like intermingle the information and whatnot. And yeah, he definitely was borrowing from Dickens and was like playing and leaning into a lot of different inspirations.
I meant specifically the Orphan's Twist that's used, like the bag of spicy of spices that Bug uses to mm-hmm. to incapacitate that yellow jacket.
Yeah.
The name is An Orphan's Twist.
Oh, I would almost guarantee it.
It seems like a direct like nod to mm-hmm. Oliver Twist, but I wasn't sure.
Yeah. Yeah. I would go so far as to claim boldly, yes, that seems like it's directly inspired. It's worth noting, too, just like a little thing on Scott Lynch himself. Scott Lynch is from our state, from Minnesota. He's a Minnesota author.
Do you know where? Author. Any idea?
The curiosity-ish.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well.
Yeah. Yeah. Cities.
Yeah.
At the very least, that was my understanding. I'm going to triple check that real quick, but I'm 95% sure that was the case.
I know half the state lives. It's fine. Right.
Yeah.
But it'd be cool if it was like, I don't know, he lives down the street from me in some sort of way.
Yeah. No, now he lives in Connecticut, Massachusetts. Boo. Massachusetts, I think.
Boo.
But he did live in St. Paul for a long time.
The notorious Minnesota Connecticut rivalry.
Pipeline. Yeah. I think it's Massachusetts now. I think he lived in Connecticut for a second and then Massachusetts. Okay. But yeah, he did like this is such a fucking tangent within a tangent now. But St. Paul, Minnesota is where he was born and raised, 1978. And he did like real life LARPing and was the subject of a documentary in 2004 with like a vampire like LARP game.
Interesting.
Because like people didn't really like know the way that those like RPG games were played. So there's like a whole documentary and he's like the central focus, which is very interesting.
That's not too long before you and I did some LARPing in our hometown.
Yeah, the like zombie game.
No. We'll get into that later. I'm pretty sure you were there. Like
I think I went once. I think I know what you're like talking about. Like a park by predominantly did that.
Yeah, Neil
and Neil. Yeah,
with their older brothers. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. I think I went once.
I think I only went like a couple once or twice or something. But yeah.
Yeah. We leaned more in on the like zombie LARP game that we did, which was more like tag, but. It was basically tag. Great fucking time.
Tag in a church at night,
and it was fucking incredible.
So much fun.
What I wouldn't give. But anyway, yeah, so he did that for a while. Subject of this really cool documentary. Very interesting. He also, there's like a great interview with him and, oh God, Between Two Perns. I'm forgetting the name specifically, but if you YouTube Between Two Perns Scott Lynch, it is an incredible like 40-minute interview that is like layered with deep humor. And you can kind of get like how Scott Lynch as a person is also how he appears on the page. Like it is identical. It is so interesting. I've never... Like, so character we, voice is so clear.
We heard about Between Two Perns. Maybe it was Leanna talking about it.
Yeah, think it talking about the Joe Abercrombie interview. I also definitely watched that.
Only other time I've...
Jackson Dickert, that's his name. But Between Two Perns, Jackson Dickert. So.
Gotcha. Strong name.
Very, very strong name. Cool. Yeah. So anyway, Scott Lynch writes this excellent book. The process and the origination of this is a part of that interview, is very interesting. He... basically was blogging the beginning of this book and was like writing it and like then documented his outline, and someone approached him to buy the book before he had written the book. So like he'd only written like 50 pages basically and was working through it in live time and like went totally reverse into the industry. So
interesting.
Yeah. What 50 pages? I don't know. What outline? I don't know. Did it change? I don't know. But what an interesting approach.
Yeah, that's really unique. I'm curious Like, that's something that only happens because of a well-established sort of, or I should take that back. That only happens in a semi-established internet forum culture.
Yeah.
Like, I wonder if that could happen now anymore.
I don't think
so. With how internet forums have gotten.
Correction. Hang on. I think you're right. I think you're entirely correct, because there are these like large web serials, right, that do eventually become something else, you know, and or get like adapted or purchased or changed or then like republished. There's this whole thing that's going on with fan fiction, and that's happening a lot in the like romance fan fiction space, being like republished and stripped of whatever IP it is and then publishes something else. So, yeah, I kind of do feel like there's a pocket out there, you know, that does exist. However, it's generally not like an original IP or idea like this in the same way. The only
when was this published?
2006.
Okay. Yeah, that's right in sort of the pocket of what I'm talking about. I think the internet has gotten too big.
I'm agreeing with you.
To be a like a viable source in general. For that path. Like I think there's a very narrow window of time where that path to publishing existed.
the other person of whom kind of broke through in a similar way is John Scalzi. He was a blogger for Yahoo, like one of the big prolific bloggers for Yahoo back in the day, hired and paid for to write for Yahoo. And he basically just started like live blogging his book, and they went, wait, stop. We're buying that. And
how
he became an author as well.
Astonishes me that Yahoo exists.
It's kind of crazy. I mean, I think, you know,
it's not what it was.
Yeah.
I think it's still pretty well respected for like financial news and things.
It's a good aggregator. And like, they do also make a ton of money off of their fantasy segment, which is wild, but fantasy football and like sports. That's what I meant. Not like fantasy, but like we're talking about with this book.
I feel like ESPN itself and Sleeper have kind of overstepped. I guess Yahoo, like March Madness is kind of the only thing I think of for Yahoo Sports at this point.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry. Like, I don't know why I'm going off on random fucking internet tangents today.
It's because it's new info.
I think that's good a segue as anyway to like get into the actual book.
Right. It's such a weird chain of events we've traced ourselves down here. But it's such a cool story. Scott Lynch's story is great. I highly recommend. The more that you read, the crazier it gets, I think, in my opinion.
I like it better now. I already liked the book. And mm-hmm. As soon as we're done here, like, I've got to read Red Country, but
half of it.
Which, you know, we'll make announcements on that soon.
Yeah.
But I also just want to read the second one of this right away.
I know. I'm actually pausing my Name of the Wind read specifically for other reasons that are also related potentially to announcements. And I think I'm going to read the second book of this instead. But I also have to read half of Red Country. So like,
right.
Motherfuck.
Anyway, where I was going with that was I like him better. I like this book better knowing that it's a Minnesotan that wrote it. Like there's some primal kinship that has erupted in my brain.
Your chest is just thumping all that much harder for this one. I get it. Okay, let's get into the story itself. The orphan of it all, right? The Charles Dickinson nature. We start with the thief maker and with our boy, because we've read the whole book and we know that he's our boy.
He's our boy pretty much immediately.
Immediately. And there are so many. It's so unfortunate that I don't have a physical copy, because I would love to rip out so many of the quotes in this book, because it's littered with incredible quotes and incredible writing. Unfortunately, not the time to replace for this time, but oh my God, some of this stuff with the thief maker is just incredible. You know, I think, kind of paraphrasing here, he would have the ability or gall to like steal the shirt off of your back and like offer it back to you. You know, like just the ease with which Locke is described as this master thief from a very young age is incredible.
As a 5 year old. He's five years old at this point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's crazy. I again, second listen through, loved the thief maker so much. I think like, I don't know what it was about, like you mentioned that you've heard complaints about the audio narrator
from one of our own patrons.
Like I get that, And I felt that way immediately. And then for whatever reason, it clicked and now I like it. Now it's good. It's good now.
Exactly. I think I texted you that. I was like, don't worry about it. It gets so good.
Yeah, exactly. But now I like the narrator too. Like that as the story clicked in, I don't know if it was the, like, there was something jarring about the narrator. I don't know what it was.
I think it's the voice that the Thief Maker has specifically, which does fit the character. I think that's
it. It fits the character. That's the thing. It really does. Yeah. But there was just something so jarring about it that it distracted from me a lot in that first read through. And I got so much more out of it the second time I listened through it.
Yeah, I believe that. And I feel very similarly. I didn't reread the whole book twice, but I did reread the prologue twice at this point. And I do kind of agree that after, you know, reapproaching it even just a second time without reading the rest of the story, I was like, okay, I get where we're going. I finally have like a pace and a rhythm. I can understand sort of the way that this is progressing. And it just worked. And the Thief Maker is so interesting. Selling to Father Chains and then getting the whole setup. Also, how do you feel about the structure of this story and the way that it's told in and of itself, right? Like the, you know, we get the modern day, the current day, contemporary timeline, and then the interlude flashbacks.
Yeah, and the interludes are long enough that it almost feels like two stories all put together. I was just thinking about that before we started recording, thinking about the second book and how it feels like we're at this, like, pretty great point to wrap up the story, potentially. Like this could be a standalone book and not be a series.
You could
and
totally treat it like one. Yeah.
I'd be perfectly happy with that. Things wrap up really well, but there are dangling threads here and there, and that's fine. And that's like, nothing has to be wrapped up perfectly. But given how this structures, we've got Locke's entire life as potential sequels. Like we can just keep going on these interludes of him as a child before we've ever met him as like a grown gentleman bastard and priest of the 13th. I liked it. I the first time it jumped to the first time it jumped back. So like the first time after the prologue where it jumped back to the child, the 5-year-old Locke perspective, I didn't know what to think. It felt very different for some reason. Like I know this structure exists, or it feels like it exists. Like it doesn't feel like super unique, but it feels so well done. And I kept wanting these interludes to continue also. Like I'm excited to get back to Locke in present day, quote unquote present day, but I just wanted more childhood Locke.
It's so unique, and I want to say this. There are several books, obviously, that are structured similarly enough or have like adjacent ideas or, you know, like are kind of like this. This is the best execution of it, though, that I've ever read. Like, this is incredible. It's miraculous. I wanted, to your same point, both timelines, just to keep reading two different books simultaneously. Like I felt like I was reading two books in a positive way, not in a bad way. Like we complain, we've talked about like some books feeling like two books and that being a negative or like being like a weird tonal thing. This is so great because it all works together in tandem perfectly, brilliantly.
It's not just little flashbacks. Like obviously these are flashbacks that are relevant to the story going forward. Oftentimes imminently, immediately relevant. Sometimes, like in the case of the...
Sometimes
long games. Like the, I just have to wait for Jean to return. Like that one is a few interludes separated from like the payoff of it. But there's, in the books that I've read, and I can't think of what they are, but you might be able to help me out. I don't know, maybe you can't. It feels like repetitive flashbacks are short, like really, really tiny and almost too spoon-feedy in like, this is the thing that we're going to be talking about. Like this is
that's
the
like a
memory.
Sandersonism in most cases, not in the Stormlight Archive, but in most other cases, that's very Sanderson-esque.
Okay.
As far as examples that we've read, I would say that Sanderson does much more flashbacking and in the short to prove something as opposed to like the story integrated into the story.
where this feels so, I mean, it's so much more time. He gets to live in it for a lot longer. And there are a handful of lessons and a handful of meaningful things that happen in each interlude. Some of them come back, some of them don't, and that's fine. It just feels alive. It feels really good.
Oh, I'm so with you. I truly passionately love this book. Just real quick, just so we can like put this out there, because we're going to keep like lauding praise, I think. I'm at a 9.5 out of 10. I fucking love this book. Like, yep. I very close to a perfect novel. My exception, you know, as far as like a complaint goes, is that I do think it takes a while to get into the like meat of the story and like where it's going. But that's not really a problem. I mean, like, it is, but it isn't. Like, I enjoyed the travel there enough that like, you know, like before we get to Barsabi, it's like 5 chapters, right? And you're like, where the fuck is any of this going? And then by the time it gets there, you're like, I don't care.
Yeah, I think I'd just give it a 10.
Sure. Yeah. I'll just give author, it a, too, by the way. This is his first fucking book. Awesome. Yeah, like, this is incredible.
The complaint that I have for it is the same as and less than the complaint that I have for Red Rising.
Sure. Intro, hard to get through.
And that's it.
Yeah. Cool.
You all know, right. Like that's, yeah.
And
that's,
it's a much longer intro than Red Rising. So, you know, not trying to laud shade on one of our favorite series, but yeah.
No, that was to express, like, obviously we love that book series, and this has in my, like, if I want to boil it down to a single complaint, that's the only complaint, and they're the same. And this one is less of a complaint. Like, this one's a lower volume super complaint. Fair. Yeah.
Yeah. Cool. All right. Yeah. I can't believe I've waited so long to read this book. Like, this has been sitting on the shelf, like mentally on my like shelf TBR for so long. And I was just
I have my, like, you've seen, yeah. I think you've been to my house since I've like put this desk in, right?
No, you put the desk in.
Okay.
No. Yeah.
Then I've sent you a picture of my like little tiny bookshelf that I have above my computer that holds maybe 20 books. Mm-hmm. And I'm buying, I've resolved to buy probably the whole series. How many books are in this series?
So, okay, maybe we should address this real quick.
I should know that first.
There are currently 3 books in the series.
Okay.
There are 3 forthcoming novellas. Scott has taken a very long break. There's going to be a total of 5 books, 5 full books.
He plus kind 3 of, novellas, or is the 3 novellas like
plus
one
Plus 3
book?
Novellas.
Okay.
Plus 3 novellas. So at the moment, the current game plan is 3 books. I think the last published book was in 2013. It's been a bit. And in 2019, he claimed to have finished the first draft of the fourth book in the series, which I think is called The Thorn of Emberlane. I said 2019. It's 2026.
Okay.
It's still not published. Yep.
It's 2025, but.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. I mean, it won't be published in 2026 is what I maybe meant to say in my head, because the novellas are starting to roll out this year, being published in magazines first and like other publications, then to be collected into maybe a collection or published individually. So
interesting. All right.
He is finally back in the world. Well, he's back in the world and publishing those things again. He's been in the world the whole time. He's actually a pretty big, like, political outspoken person and like a great writer on the side. He's very smart and intelligent and a great follow on social media if anyone is looking for one as well. Yeah. Okay.
Cool.
So
anyway,
it's one of the great unfinished series, though, that a lot of people whine about. So
for now, I think it'll take the spot of The Institute, Lisey Story, and Needful Things on my little...
Take the Stephen King down.
Take the little Stephen King down. I think that's what'll happen.
And you haven't read Needful or The Institute yet, right?
Correct.
Cool.
And I haven't technically read Lisey Story.
Oh, I thought you did.
But I have watched it.
Yeah, we watched it for sure, and we talked.
I found this, like, it's a really beautiful hardcover copy.
There are a couple of beautiful hardcover treatments of that book, which is crazy. Do you have the shovel one? With the, like, roses? Yeah, that one's incredible. That's the one that
I found it at Savers for $2.99.
Nice.
And it's in, like...
Very good.
I don't think anyone's opened that book.
That is... We are in so many side tangents within this episode, but to cap that one, that is my favorite thing to do with Stephen King. I have a spreadsheet specifically so that I can ensure that
found,
I have what
we
I
found
have.
Needful Things at that used bookstore when you were hunting.
In Tennessee, yeah. Anytime I'm in a new city, I go to a used bookstore. I look for one of the Stephen King books on my list in a first edition or a second edition or whatever. I only buy one, even if they have multiple, because I'm only ever going to be able to do this so many times.
That's why I got your second copy of Needful Things.
Well, because right? I didn't actually grab a copy of Needful Things. I grabbed Cujo.
Oh, because you didn't want to buy multiple
at the same place. Yes, that was my rule. Yep. Yeah. So I got Cujo. You got Needful Things.
Well, if you want to buy my first edition copy of Needful Things for a dollar at my self-set-up used bookstore, you can.
I will get desperate for it elsewhere. I'm not worried about it. That's the thing with Stephen King. You can find him anywhere. And that's kind of like the benefit, you know, of the king himself.
Yeah.
It's really easy to find those books. It's just kind of like a fun hunting mission to do so. Mm-hmm. I did technically kind of cheat in that trip, though. I did buy two Stephen King books, but one was a replacement for a book that I already had with a spine that was failing. So I replaced my copy of Songs of Susanna,
right,
which is a Dark Tower book. So crazy side tangent aside, but it belongs on that shelf, though. I'm with you.
It belongs on that shelf because mainly because the Audible cover, I'm assuming, is the same as the hardcover cover, and it's really pretty.
Oh, that is the brand new cover. That is the brand new cover, because there was a different cover beforehand. But yes, gotcha. That is the new covers. Yep.
I love the font. I love the the shadows, and yeah, if it's prohibitively expensive, I'm probably not gonna jump at it, but you know, that's my plan right now, is to throw those up on the bookshelf.
Yeah, it's not. Those are like the currently available editions versus the older ones. That said, the broken binding did do a crazy treatment of the books that I think came out last year, and I'm maybe now hunting for those, and those are more expensive.
Okay.
I do need to pony up my money for the middle trilogy of The First Law first before I will go that direction, which now has increased to like $600. Okay. Anyway, I should have done it back when I could have done it. Oh, woof, no. Woof. Woof. It'll be fine. Those books are some of my favorite books of all time, the ones that we're reading right now. So I could care a little less. Okay. Get back to the story that we're here to talk about. Locke in the introduction is so incredible. The interludes play so well. I adore Father Chains. Father Chains is one of my favorite characters in the entire book. He's so interesting. He's so like smart and intellectual. He's such a different spin on like the Obi-Wan Yoda character, Fagin, you know, if we're talking like Oliver Twist and Charles Dickens. Like, I mean, he's such a different character.
Leaning on the term father, I think works really well. Like he really becomes a harsh but fair father figure to these orphans.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's also a step further than that, right?
Like, I agree with you. It's more than that, too. Yeah, you're right.
But I totally agree with you. I think that it is that. I just think that there's, like, this extra layer there where he is also partaking in the same crime. And so, like, there's this equanimity. Like, he is a gentleman bastard as well. And so there's, like, this... Like, he is in charge, yes, but he's like, nah, I'm also just one of you guys. Like, I want good food. You want good food? Cool. I'm going to teach you how to make good food, and then you're going to make me good food, and we have an exchange. And, like, there's something delightful there.
The dynamic is different later on, but technically, Locke is in Chains' position during, like, the majority of this book, the non-interlude sections of this book, is Locke as the priest of the Crooked Warden.
Right.
But they really do act differently. Mm-hmm. And I think it's because all of the people, or a majority of the people, minus Bug, grew up together as brothers, as family, with Chains being like, they're well below preteens for the majority of the interludes. Like, starting out, Locke is 5. Jean comes in at like, Jean comes in.
We said that at the same time. That's so good.
He comes in at like 6 or something.
Yeah.
6 or 7.
I think he's 7 because his parents die, or 9. Like he's more educated.
Yeah. Anyway, the Sansa twins are a couple years older than
Jean Tannen. Yeah.
than either of them. Like they're, but they're all relatively similar in age, which by the like contemporary timeline, it you'd be hard pressed to call me wrong for saying they're the same age.
Yeah,
all four.
They
of
all
them.
Feel the same.
And then Bug is their little apprentice boy, but not. Yeah, he's not a second, and he's not an apprentice. No. Never has been. He's a gentleman bastard through and through. As
never was. Yeah, technically. I mean, because he didn't make it.
They don't have seconds. They don't have apprentices. No,
I know. I'm just saying he also never was. But he couldn't have been because he was also dead.
Well, that's too.
Yeah.
But yeah. Anyway, so my point being, Locke steps into Chains' position, but Chains, yes, was a member of the Gentleman Bastards, the leader of the Gentleman Bastards, but also the father of all these boys. Like there were no other adult members at that point.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. In part because he needed to like create them in a way that like they couldn't betray, because like his goal, I don't know if you felt this way. It's very interesting that we're going like so non-linear as the book is also non-linear. Haha. But did any part of you think that maybe Chains was the Grey King for a second? Like I thought because of Chains's goals, where he said that he wanted to take down Kappa Varsavi, that he was the Grey King for a second and he had faked his own death and was pulling something off.
I thought it was the Thief Maker.
Okay. Yeah. I actually late in the game when we finally like saw and met the Grey King, I did also have an inkling that I thought that it was the Thief Maker as well.
So the only reason why I thought that was because I knew that we would have more, like, because I knew there's more books in this series.
Sure.
I think I knew from the jump that this was a series. I didn't know how many there were.
There will be five. There are three.
But we kind of wrap things up with the Thief Maker. We get references to him, but we don't get like more interaction with him. So it felt like his timeline was done. We don't get an actual like death of him at all. But Chains will get more of in future interludes, assuming the format stays the same.
Totally.
So that's entirely where my thought process and like my conspiracy theory brain was going on when trying to figure out who the Grey King was. And I really thought it would be the Thief Maker. But
I think that there was a certain time where that did pull into my perspective again. Like I said, like I started thinking that it was Father Chains and I was like, this lines up with what he said. This lines up with the idea. Instead, it's just like the universal thieving greed and then also what Kappa Varsavi did specifically to the Grey King. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I still have high hopes though for the Thief Maker to show back up in the future because I don't think he's confirmed as dead. So
I don't think he's ever died.
Yeah. A lot of people died though in the revolt, but
yeah, that's true.
Or were sent away. So
do we know how long it's been since Father Chains died?
I think that we feel as though it's been close to a decade-ish, if I recall correctly. I want to say Jean is in his, because we get so much information about Jean's age, so that's what's like standing out of my head. I want to say he's like 21 or 22 in this book.
Yeah.
And Locke is a year older than that.
Yeah.
And then we
know this
a year older.
The Silvaros, mm-hmm. Duke Silvara is only 24. I caught that on my second read through.
Wow. I actually didn't realize that at all. Fun fact, most of the book, I thought his wife, the Contessa, was maybe Sabatha, the missing character, right? The missing gentleman bastard.
Interesting. That didn't cross my mind.
I was like, because Chain sent these people off to be trained. And so it was like, well, and she's so good at this specific field of like alchemy that she works on. And I was just like, that like lines up and could be like a weird abduction of where like she like truly fully left and disappeared into a different life like that. So
yeah,
I don't know.
Until, that was just like until where my brain was. Did you still feel that way at the...
Oh, no. Like, halfway through the book, I abandoned that theory. But, like, early on, that was the way my brain was going.
Gotcha.
Yeah. Oh, man. There are so many different things to talk about inside of this book. Obviously, there's this, like, whole idea of the civilization that came before. Like, this... The Elder Glass and, like, these old towers and the catwalkways.
And
what do you think about, like, the world building?
It's so sparse, but so interesting. Because... Mm-hmm. We don't deal with anyone that's not human.
Right.
There are no non-human characters in this book, but there is like allusions to non-human civilizations that build some cities and some buildings and some things.
And then we're like cursed for some reason or scourged from the planet.
So like, it's so interesting. And I am intrigued and excited to learn more about it.
Yeah.
The world building is like really top notch for sure.
Yeah. And like, especially, I mean, just a step in a slightly different direction, but the whole, like, the 12 and how developed those religions feel individually and how well represented they are through Scott Lynch's brilliant characterization, where he like truly shows through subtle lines. Like, he is, oh, it's so good. You get so much character without ever being like foisted, like, Locke was good at thieving. Locke was good at robbing people. No, it's not even that we necessarily see him being good at robbing people. It's instead the implication of language that he uses to communicate, or that other people use to communicate about him, building and setting that expectation. And that goes for all of the characters. I mean, especially like Jean and the terror, Jean Tannen and the terror that he is with weapons, you know, kind of to the same degree.
Yeah, for sure.
And the Galdo twin, or the Sansa twins with cards, right?
Yeah. Like, everybody's an expert at something. And we get that in an interlude too, which I don't remember if that's immediate or not, but I don't think it is. I think that's a setup and like later reveal of Locke being sent away on his assignment. That being announced during a game of cards.
Yeah.
And Chains revealing that, of course, he's been cheating this whole time. And they're like, well, you shouldn't have told us. We're gonna practice, and we're going to get really fucking good at this card game, and we're going to get really good at cheating. And by this time next month or whatever it is, we'll beat you. And he's like, nope, you won't, because you'll be gone. And the Sansas are like, well, we're here, and we're going to get really fucking good at the card game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, instead he goes off to learn a lot of acting, right? Or is it the mother?
That's the farming.
That is the farming, yeah. The green.
Yep. Oh, those were everything is so well constructed.
The book is so good.
It's so cool. It's so good.
This is one of the best books we've read on the show, period. Like, this is like, we've read a lot of incredible novels and we've broken down a lot of them, but this one is like just delightful.
It's really good.
I've been guiding a lot of this. Is there anywhere you want to go that your brain is spinning in a direction?
I think something we haven't really talked about is the Kappas.
Yes.
Kappa Basavi.
Yep.
Yeah. The entire, also, like, sort of
for thieves stories. So,
yeah, well, that's true too.
We love Guy Ritchie, right? Like, this is our shit.
We love heists. Yeah. This whole sort of underworld that we're dealing with, which doesn't really feel like an underworld.
It's like just below the surface, which is
cool. Exactly. Like, so brazen and so open and like so basically the leader of this city. I think.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of like an acknowledged mob, right? Like, it's like the mafia being legitimized, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Asuka, the daughter that we meet as a drunk 6-year-old.
What a scene, by the way. That one threw me the fuck off in general in this. And I adored Nazca. And when she died, I was so fucking mad. I don't know that I've ever been mad at a character, as mad at a character death as that in a long time. Since maybe I don't talk about the character spoiler deaths for other series. Yeah, there are only a couple that I can think of that made me similarly mad.
Yeah, and it's so sudden. It's so immediate. And the setup, like, it simultaneously hits really hard and also feels like everyone else assumes that it hits even harder, you know? Because of the, like,
proposed engagement. Forced,
forced marriage or forced engagement. So, like, yes, she was a great friend to not only Locke, but the entirety of the Gentlemen Bastards. But I think probably primarily Locke. But she was relatively beloved in general. She was this, like, plucky, wonderful, like, cutthroat daughter of Kappa Barsavi. Like, she was a great but brief character.
Yeah, I think I was so struck because of, like, the expectation of it all, right? And, like, the weight of that sort of I mean, the whole weight of the marriage, right? That was potentially going to happen. And I am still kind of at awe because I do think that while, like, he, while Locke finds himself very stuck in the moment as he's kind of reacting to the idea and trying to figure out a way to work himself out of this marriage, if it weren't for Nazca's own intervention, this kind of seems like a pretty good deal, you know, like on the whole. Like, I don't think Barsavi is like reaching too far from like a reasonable proposal. Like, the best thief with like, who will become the best like lord of the best kappa to like oversee everything. Like, this is a perfect marriage of power. You know, like, this is a great, I mean, place to be put in. I don't know. Yeah. I felt much more positive on the arranged marriage, and I was like actually down if that was going to be the way that it went, because I liked Nazca's character so much and I thought they got along so well that I think it could have worked, although maybe
I think
not,
they would have gotten out of it.
Yeah.
I think eventually
after he died maybe, but like
I felt like yeah. that was going to be a like another not heist but like heist adjacent subplot. Of like a well-constructed plan on how to get out of an arranged marriage.
I almost felt like the Grey King was going to become like a background for like the second book, if that makes sense, just because like how adjacent he was.
It surprised me how quickly things escalated. Like, that's the last time we see Nazca.
Yeah, and then she dies.
Yeah. It's I don't know, like, because of this like non-linear structure of this book, I don't remember the order in which things happen. Like, I know, okay, that's the wrong way to put it. I don't remember how much happens in between these points on these, like, separate sort of timeline, like, separate...
Which is also why we're jumping around.
Yeah,
yeah,
for sure. But, yeah, things just go so quickly with, like, each individual little thread that we're dealing with.
Yeah. Let's maybe to try to pin this before we talk about, like, the murder and then subsequent plan and plot that the Great King pulls off for Barsavi. Let's talk about him, right? Barsavi himself and sort of the introduction, this like pirate king kind of character, although Italian instead, and sort of the whole like Venetian influence of this is obvious and redolent across the whole thing, the canals and, you know, like it feels like Venice in a lot of different ways. I'm curious on what you thought of Barsavi and also the like thieving system within the world.
It is until I read this sort of summary calling this out as an underworld.
Yeah.
I had forgot, like, I'm sure it's outlined as such, but it really felt like he was the external leader of this city. Like,
and I think that's real. Yeah.
It didn't feel like there was any governing body of the city other than this.
Oh, interesting. I can't remember the Duke's name, but I did view him as the higher like authority that he still reported to, but like they were more like even partners than
like the Dons, you mean?
No, I'm thinking the actual Duke. What's his name? Is it Don? Maybe it is Don. I thought it was
The Dons are like the noble people.
Yeah, but it was the Steppe, not the Silvaras.
We might have said Duke Silvaro earlier, by the way. I meant to say Don Silvara if we said Duke.
Okay. Yes, it is Duke. So they're the Dons beneath. The Duke is above. It's Duke Nicavante.
Right. Yes, Nicavante, yeah. Which we don't really interact with much. Like there's some commentary on Nicavante. There's like Nicavante the Elder and Nicavante the Younger. Like, right? I think... Like
he has a son, and I think that's mentioned through the spider or Vorcenza, and like they talk about things like that. But for the most part, Duke Nicavante is sort of the assumptive, you know, character.
Okay, so even so, he seems like the leader of the region, state, if you will,
the governor,
and the kappa is the leader of the city. Like it didn't feel unofficial. In any sort of capacity, governmental.
Yeah.
So calling it an underworld kind of threw me off for some reason. I don't know why.
Yeah, I agree. I think that the only reason that I kind of think of it as like an underworld in any degree is Locke is playing underneath that layer. And so like he is the underworld. You know, like Locke is really living in the underworld versus the like thieving world that is legitimized above it.
Yeah, that's fair.
Yeah.
You mentioned the spider.
Mm-hmm.
Should we roll into talking about...
Yeah, the Silvaras, the spider. Yeah, sure.
Yeah. So we get this like grand scheme
mm-hmm.
that that really plays out so fucking well.
Mm-hmm.
That makes its way to the other high lady who Doña Silvara is mm-hmm. Privy to the idea or kind of assumes that she has a connection to the spider and she is the spider, which was
as
a great,
it turns out, yeah.
Great reveal and so fucking obvious on at least second read through. I can't remember if I assumed it on the first read through.
I didn't. Okay. Until the secret letter was discussed, or like sending a letter, and we don't learn about the seal until like two chapters later, like the secret seal. But yeah. I was like, that's sus. But before that, I was not keyed in.
All the actual, like all the commentary hints mm-hmm. so heavily towards that being the case.
I think she's old, and we just assume that she's knowledgeable. You know what I mean? Like that's kind of where my brain went at the time, I think.
Yeah, maybe it's just because I knew that, sure. Like, I'm attributing assumptions to, or attributing doublespeak to the words that she says.
Yeah. She's incredible. What a great character introduction. The Silvaras in the game that's played on them themselves is so incredibly well thought out. The Lucas Fairwhite bit and component, and like the Ostershallen brandy and the entirety of that sort of like robbery on their end, the particulars of the growth and like the way that this is managed is also interesting in the way that, you know, are that like the expert acting of Locke plays out against Doña Silvara. And yeah, that brings us basically to then the confrontation with Vorcenza. There's one more kind of intermediary step there where Locke adopts the personality of someone who is working for Duke Nicovante to try to capture the thorn. And the person that he is playing is also him, like he's the one playing it. I don't know. Did you believe that that was a legit character at first? Or did you think or did you realize that that was Locke when that
first time
shows up?
Totally believed it was an actual Midnighter.
I thought so. I thought so too.
Yeah. But because I think right.
Was that his name?
I can't remember the name. But right before that, I think is the first time we get a perspective that's not Locke's. Like, for the most part, this book follows Locke. It's third person omniscient, I think. I think that's what you would call this.
Well, no. Because we are like locked into perspectives, right? So like when we're in a perspective, we're locked in.
Not really, though.
What do you mean?
Like,
it's not first person, right? So we're not like narratively driven by their internal monologue.
Right.
Yeah. It's third person limited, but it hops around.
I guess that's where.
Yeah.
Yes.
Omniscient is like we're given all of the information and like nothing is kept secret because you can't keep secrets in omniscient. Yes. Yeah.
Yep.
Like Dune is omniscient.
Okay. So, but we're third person almost exclusively following Locke for like
most of the
almost
book.
Half of the book.
I would say closer to like 70%. Yeah.
Yeah. And then we get into like following Jean.
Yep.
And then we get
the Silvaras and some other angles.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I felt
get their perspective, but it's like very limited.
But for some reason, I felt like we got a perspective that wasn't Locke's pretty recently before the Midnighter that was Locke. But I might be wrong. That might have been early enough in the book that I just didn't know the format yet.
Well, we do get Don Silvara's perspective in that moment.
Yeah, so we do.
Like
we do.
We're in his when the Midnighter shows up.
Okay. And we're in his before, like when he intercedes the attack on Lucas.
Yes. Yep. Well. So we kind of see that whole thing play out. And then also.
And that's like, really early. So like my whole thing is fucked.
No.
Anyway.
Also like the book, we are going non-linear fully here as a bit unintentionally, intentionally.
It's all good.
You're going to enjoy this regardless.
I really didn't believe. Mm-hmm. Like I didn't have a clue that this was Locke to begin with the first time. And again, felt obvious the second time. And I'm not sure if it's hindsight or just knowing the clues to look for.
Sure.
Or both.
Yeah.
Or I just fucking knew somewhere the story, man. But it felt good both times.
Good call. Yeah. It's tough to parse specifically, but it is so, all of the game is so satisfying in that first and second section. Like the idea of like pulling this off. And then that was when the question for me to like, to what end does this play off? Or like, to what, like, where are we going here with the story? And then we get kind of more on Barsavi. We meet Barsavi in person. We get the marriage proposal thing. That goes awry. The Great King and the paranoia seeps in. And that kind of leads us down that path a little bit more as far as that goes. I think this is probably, unless you have anything to say there, this is probably a good time to talk about the Bondsmage and the idea there.
Yeah.
In not just the Falconer explicitly, but the idea of Bond's Magi and like their whole path and history and Carthinianness, as it were. What do you make?
This is like the series we're reading, the First Law series.
Mm-hmm.
A very low magic world. Maybe more magic in this world than in the First Law.
I would say so.
Like more casually used and more accessible, but still not common. And relating to that in actual monetary value to the usage of it and the practitioners of magic. But common enough that people aren't surprised by it, unlike the First Law.
I find that to be one of the most fascinating things about this whole idea, right? Is that these people are just available for purchase, you know, to some degree. Incredibly expensive. But like this idea of not maintaining loyalty or allegiance, and then also the general like fortification that they have around their guild or their union, wherein retribution is punished so severely when they're like extracting some of the most egregious acts upon humanity, including like the loss of their own will and all these other things. Like, how would people have dealt with it's just so fucked up. The whole system is so fucked up.
Yeah.
I love the idea of Bondsmages. I hate them as people.
I agree with that completely. It did give I didn't necessarily understand the scale of the monetary system in general. I think we got enough here and there to be relatable and to understand the depth of some of these high value purchases.
Yeah.
Because we know that Bondsmage prices are $1,000 per day or 1,000 full crowns per day.
White crowns. Yeah. Yep. Was it gold crowns or white crowns?
What white irons are 5. I think it was a 1,000 crowns is what they said.
Okay. Got it.
White irons are like a higher like subset.
Yes, higher tier, which is why when he gets like one, it's such a big deal.
Yeah.
And then they get 20,000 for the job, basically.
They get 25,000, which is more than half of the Silvara's entire like fortune.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So call it half, call 50,000 in an incredibly large fortune.
Right.
Not the largest in the city, but fucking huge. 1,000 per day.
Big deal.
And he's been employed for at least a couple months.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Like we're dealing with fortunes.
Yes. Yeah. True fortunes. It's stated, I think, in the book that, like, I think a Yellow Jacket makes like 5 or 6 crowns a year, right? Like full crowns in a whole year. And like Locke stole 1 crown in his youth. And that led to like a really big problem. In addition to
that,
the whole, like,
that led to him being like, okay to be killed.
A mass murder of children. And then also,
It
was bad.
Yeah. Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that goes to prove Scott's ability to create this ambiguous like a money system.
Mm-hmm.
And let us understand the value of things in relative terms really well.
Yeah. Yeah. and also like what the Great King like places on this, and like how much effort must have gone in to employ this Bonds Magi for months, yep. you know, to like make this happen.
Right.
Yeah. It's a tough look. Tough look. What a moment. Yeah. So let's talk about where this story kind of pivots around, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Let's talk about like where this story kind of goes awry, right? The absolute bloodbath that this moment is leading to. So Nazca is killed by the Great King. The Great King communicates with Locke that he is to take his place as a part of an arrangement to meet with Copper Barsavi to imitate him one time, as he's a great actor and otherwise. And there's this wonderful trick that the Great King plays in which he actually lets Barsavi get a hold of him and kill him, leading to Barsavi throwing a party. And that's a lot to talk about in and of itself. So maybe we'll dissect that.
No, that's, I think, yeah. I mean, the act itself is masterfully played on both parts. Locke yeah, plays it so well.
Barrel horse piss. Yeah.
Okay. First of all, I've got to talk about the barrel horse piss because,
oh my God,
is it a normal thing to collect horse piss? Because it felt like Locke just understood from the look of this like hazy piss barrel that it was horse piss. Like, do people just collect that shit? Like, I wouldn't know horse piss from any other piss if I saw it in a barrel, but he seemed to like understand, oh, it's hazy. It's like not clear. It smells like shit, but all piss does. Well, piss smells like piss, but you know what I mean?
Yeah, right.
Like,
yeah.
But just, it was immediately identifiable. Sure. As horse yeah. piss.
I would go as far as to say it's probably because of his general alchemical prowess. But on top of that, I am...
Barsavi knows it too.
Yes. Okay, here's my other explanation. And this is the only way that I can rationalize this in my brain, right? This is my like canons of probability speaking to you. Animals used to piss on the street all the time, right? Like horses and like shit and piss like ran in the streets of London for most of history. And so I kind of assume that there's like a general understanding of like what an animal shit smells like or piss. And that's the only way that I can rationalize it.
That's otherwise, fair.
It is so specific. It's like, what is happening? But that's the only way that I can think about it.
So, yeah, I like that as an answer. Yeah. Okay. Sorry.
Like it's just so common in the roads that it's like, you understand. But
yeah. That makes sense. But
the opacity, him knowing like, yes, if I hold this up against the light kind of a thing is like a little, I mean, he didn't actually do that, but it's stretching credulity a little bit.
Yeah, exactly.
Credulity. Yeah.
But then bringing that in as the ironic plan that Barsavi has to
kill the Grey King, in quotes.
Kill yeah. the Grey King, who tipped off Barsavi, clearly.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's so many layers of well played on mm-hmm. all fronts. Locke plays it yeah. well. Locke and the Gentleman Bastards, like that is a big plan that's unfolded to get Locke sick and then healthy again, healthy mm-hmm. enough again.
Oh my God, yeah.
And then
the
back.
Price is a big deal in the end.
Yeah. Barsavi, having been fed information and like understands what is and is not an actual like bondsmage spell, the Grey King himself orchestrating all of it, like it's layer upon layer upon layer. It is mm-hmm. an onion of reveals, and it all culminates so perfectly in this. It's not the climax of the story, I don't think, but it kind like of one. Is. Yeah. It really feels mm-hmm. like it.
Mm-hmm. I think the burning boat and the sword fight at the end are yeah. the climax, and Jean's axe fight as well.
Right. There's a lot of climaxes.
Yeah, there's so many good beats. I'll get back to this in just a moment. I just want to mention Warner Brothers for a very long time owned the rights to this to develop right after the first book was published. And my God, what a movie this would make. Like, it's Fantasy Ocean's 11, right? Like, it's incredible.
Yeah, it's really,
this
really
is what
good.
King Arthur wanted to be, the Guy Ritchie movie, without the baggage of, like, setting up a new franchise.
Right. Yep.
Yeah. I still love that movie, but it has problems.
I do too.
But
it does.
It's
a good
movie. It's good. It's got issues. It's good. Yeah. Okay. Okay. So back to the point here, though. I adore this. I have not in recent history, when I've been reading something outside of the Age of Madness trilogy, of which we'll get to very soon, have I felt like I was going to shit my pants while I was reading a scene. which is how I felt with the spiders and bug and like the whole thing going on under the dock. Like, that's one example in this book where like we're introduced to a thing and then it shows up right away. But it also worked because of how absolutely fucking terrifying that was from Jean's perspective on the whole thing.
For sure.
Ugh.
Knowing that these are fucking terrifying to begin with. And then also there's the comedic beat of like, they shouldn't be acting like this. And like, okay, good. You tell them that.
Right. This is unusual. Okay. What are we going to do about it? Because there's nothing we can do about it.
They shouldn't be doing this. They fucking are. Yeah. I don't know what to tell you, man. Yeah, man. I remember it taking a little bit of time to understand that they were spiders.
Yeah.
For some reason.
At first, it wasn't quite clean.
I think the name Salt Devil lends itself to like sea creature, and we're dealing with sharks all the time in this story. Like, I thought maybe it was some sort of sea creature again, but spiders, dude. Spooters. Spooderman.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm not, in general, in love with spiders as a fear of mine. But to your point, the whole sand description did kind of make me give like scorpion vibes, although they didn't have the scorpion tail, which is interesting because I think the bird has scorpion-esque talons,
It's a scorpion hawk.
Yeah. Right.
Poison talons, which is a good combo.
Mm-hmm.
Or stingers on the legs or something, whatever it is.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's stingers on the talons or something very adjacent. God damn it, do I love this book. Okay, hang on. The whole like being stuck in the piss barrel thing and the way that they survive that, of course, because of the sickness and the illness and kind of working its way down. We get out of the barrel, of course. All of this plays out. Kappa Raza then he assassinates Barsavi, kills him, kind of taking his place and then also taking a lot of his soldiers over in sort of what is the big swing moment in so many ways of the story.
Huge
simultaneously
swing.
Vorchenza begins to take over or rather begins to like really unearth the Thorn of Kamor and really kind of find him and sets a plan and a trap. And so we have two different plans and traps then kind of set. Caparaza's already off on his own right, and he's ready to take care of the dukes and everyone else that's in sort of the nobility for the scourge that they brought upon the family, which we also find that like a crazy reveal in which the twins that were working for Barsavi as these like presenters of the shark fighting pit thing, which is such a cool
tooth shows.
The teeth shows. Ugh, man, this book is just so delightful with so many ideas and such a presentation.
Mm-hmm.
What'd you feel? How'd you feel about the mid climax? We'll see.
It was just astonishing.
Mm-hmm.
Not only like that it happened, but how well it was pulled off and how surprising all of it was and how well written all of it was. Like it had everything. It was well written. It was surprising. It wasn't like too much, but it wasn't too like it was still in overpouring cup of surprises. Like thread the fucking needle, man.
Like
it was so much fun.
I said this in our I've been scrolling through for a moment just to try to find the thing. I think Scott Lynch is kind of like the Stephen King of fantasy, and let me just kind of give you an explainer there. King, you've read Salem's Lot, you've read nothing else. But Salem's Lot I think is enough of it.
The short story that we read
Yeah. About the dog in Florida and whatever. But giving Salem's Lot as an example, King does such a good job building up the world as a part of it and then kind of letting that story like naturally bleed itself to the conclusion in which we reach without it feeling contrived in any sort of more serious way. And to me, Scott Lynch manages the same thing here with sort of the Barsavi accumulation. All of these things seem like disparate parts that we're experiencing until they all begin to like move in the same direction and roll down into this massive conclusion. And that's how I felt about the cumulative weight of this section. It was just like unpredictable, but also so exciting.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
This quote fucking got me. It's so dumb. It's so quick. It's so short. Eat hemp and shit rope. And it's just such a like such a concise. Like,
it's
oh
so
my
good.
God. It's so indicative of the humor too of this book.
Eat hemp and love shit it. Rope.
Yeah, eat hemp and shit
that's
rope.
That's something that I could use. Like that's that
a rope
that's
generator.
Not like that's well I what I mean is like that is an insult that is unique, mm-hmm. but not like unique to the fantasy world that we're living in. Like that, mm-hmm. that's just a new insult that could work here in this world.
Yeah, right. And there are so many. This book is littered with insults. I mean, like the entire idea of the bastards, like cheers and salute, and you know,
I loved
like,
that
moment. Oh, it's so such a good moment of camaraderie.
Liar.
Yeah, liar, liar, liar. Bastard.
Bastard.
Yeah. What a strong, strong moment throughout a lot of this book. Yeah. Okay. So the reveal happens. The sisters kill Barsavi for the most part, leaving the Great King to the very end to do so. The Bonds Mage seems to sort of like leave service as he's like unnecessary as Raza actually takes over.
Billy is still in service controlling the shark, right?
Yes. I'm saying a little bit after that, but yes, you're right. Yeah, yeah, in the moment he's controlling the shark. I was saying like after the fact, Locke finds him after he is used to kill the rest of the crew that remains. So right. We lose the twins in a sort of brutal moment as we come to the house and almost lose Jean as well in a moment of near mind control.
All of that.
Yeah. All the money is gone.
Yep.
They're stripped of everything.
They make a great point at the beginning of the book talking about their vaults, quote unquote, not having any sort of locks on them. Like they're just fucking holes.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. All of it is everything plays into everything. Like everything is relevant, but just the physical requirements that like the physicality of stealing 40,000 gold,
yeah.
40,000 crowns worth of smaller denomination gold and coins is incredible. It's so much movement. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The wall that was created when they were counting out the 5,000 was like a room.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, all of it.
Yeah.
All of it plays in like every single thing on this reread of it has been like, oh, that's relevant. Oh, that's relevant. Oh, this is relevant. Like, it, and none of it felt out of place when it was described
not a
the first time through.
Is wasted. Yeah.
Not a sentence is wasted, but also like it didn't feel like it was pointing to something the first time through. Like it didn't feel like it was.
It's not illusory. Yeah.
Yeah. It just felt like world building for the most part. And it all comes together.
Yeah.
Fucking everything.
Yeah. It's a pretty heroic effort in as far as like a book goes in general. Okay. So this massive theft happens. We lose the twins. I was heartbroken by the loss of the twins. They were some of my favorite characters.
They were great.
I truly felt brutalized. Bug made sense. Felt bad, but Bug made sense to me.
Bad made twins, sense, yeah. I agree.
I truly did not expect by any stretch. Yeah. We then lead to maybe my favorite part of the novel. My favorite part of the novel is this casual thievery that happens with the small duke that is the banker. And I love the manipulation of the fucking chef workers and like playing through the first play when he's like going and he's approaching the banker directly being like, I need a loan. I'm playing off this character. He goes, no. And then he takes the next step and he's like, okay, I'll steal this little thing. And then he plays the play.
He's just looking for clothes.
Yeah. And he's just, yeah, exactly. And then it's so good.
Decides in the moment, like, oh no, I know how I can take so much more.
Yeah. Take so much more to help us, you know, like, I loved that whole sequence. That whole part was, I think, my favorite part of the whole novel.
I think so, too. Yeah,
yeah,
for sure. I mean,
you and I
have an overlapping love for heist things. And this was a top to bottom single scene heist, like the whole fucking heist from like the inception of the heist happens during the first heist,
Which fails, which is also a cool element, right?
Like,
that's the nature of a lot of the movies that we love is like, there are these setbacks that then become the next step. Right. And so like, and in stories in general, and it's so well done on the page here.
And then pays off later when he, wearing this man's suit, compliments him for like, oh, I went to your same tailor and like got the suit out of your like stylish
choice. Yeah. Right.
And like all of like the bow gets tied so well. Oh, fuck, man.
Truly, truly brilliantly. I adore this part of the story for all the reasons that you've cited already. And I think that it's just fantastically done. That does lead us into sort of the, like you segued well into the sort of like ball presentation that happens up in the Komori glass towers with all of the different Dons and Donyas gathered. It's sort of set as a trap for Locke, of course. And he goes, no, no, no. After he gets trapped by Vorchenza and otherwise in the Silvaras, he goes, you don't understand. The pillars are filled
with Wraithstone.
Wraithstone, which gentles things, which is a whole different topic that we've been talking about from which the magic perspective.
Also totally like planted and understood
early. Yeah.
With the gentling of the horses and like most people's discomfort around gentled animals, and it's used very sparingly by like nobles that want animals that won't kick their children off of them for riding. Like
training and animals and
really
and, like, pulling
really
mules.
Niche uses, and the implications of it being used as a mass, not murder,
but like inepting. I don't know, like
it's crazy.
It's such a good
scheme. It's a mass and poisoning, it's so well thought out. Basically.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. That's a good comparison.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it plays out incredibly well. Obviously, like the whole thing, no one believes him. He's like, I will promise you my life and luck, and you can capture me anyway afterwards, as long as you like get this taken care of. They manage to do so, to manage the fuses and everything else that's happening there in this incredibly clever political scene. Any notes on that you want to bring up?
It also all feeds into a future plan. Like that's
conflict,
the, like,
yes. And plan.
It's Locke admitting who he is.
Right.
But trying to save everybody genuinely.
Mm-hmm.
While also layering in this little, not heist, but kind of heist. You could consider it a heist, the sinking of the ship. That is the ultimate culmination of all of this sort of strange bedfellow situation that they find themselves in between the spider and the thorn. That the sinking of the ship, he knows it to be the location of all the coin, and he's directing them to this like shit barge, this trio of shit barges that supposedly the coin is all buried under. Fucking masterful. So well, so well done. And that this is one that we're aware of, at least a little bit. Like, we know that plague ship is the location of all the money.
Yes. Yeah. We are more in on this one than any of the others.
Correct.
Up until this point.
Yeah. But it still felt fucking good.
It was so good. And also, it feels like a redemptive moment as it sunk, of course, for the boys that we lost, right? And it is this whole like thing that we've been building towards where like, the thieves grieve their own by sacrificing money that no one else can ever take in some facet. And so it goes underneath the water where the sharks are, where no one else will ever go for them forever, as like a grave of their own, like deposit for the future. And that's such a great like note to end on for those people. The book also ends there. We kind of skipped over a little thing that I want to circle back and talk about, but yeah. I mean, what a cathartic ending in so many ways.
It's through all of the deaths that happened.
Mm-hmm.
It felt like such a good ending. because of all the deaths that we've experienced. Mm-hmm. And again, the early planting of the what's it called? The death offering?
I think that's right. Death offering. That sounds right.
We get that way early.
Right, because that's the tooth that he wears around.
That's the tooth that he wears. So we get that almost immediately. First non
interlude one. Yeah.
Yeah. First non prologue chapter. First non prologue interlude. Oh man. For that to be a payoff felt so fucking good.
Yeah.
God damn it. I like this book more and more as we talk about it.
I know. It's so brilliantly layered. I adore it. for all of these things. So, okay, we'll just skip back just a little bit from that. We'll just talk about specifically sort of like the end and the culmination and climax of a lot of these different things. First off, we'll talk about the Bondsmage. The Bondsmage losing his tongue and his hands. I think he loses his tongue and his hands. Or his fingers,
hands,
right?
Or his fingers. His fingers specifically. Yeah. All of his fingers. Yeah.
So he can no longer do anything that a Bondsmage could do. He didn't kill him, which is an important distinction that hopefully very doesn't important. Send the guild after him. But, I mean, damn close.
Feels like the guild is...
not going to be happy.
They're not going to be happy, but they're very particular with their wording, as Barsavi discussed.
Right. Yeah, he didn't kill him, but he did fucking maim him. That's for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So his end is a brutal one. But again, he does basically admit to all the things that he did and does kind of give us the explainer of where the Greed King was going. We get more details on the family and sort of what that looked like. It's great in that way as he kind of pours it out to...
We get a villain monologue, and Jean. Weirdly, by not the villain.
Yeah, he is a bad person, which I think is important, but like not the bad guy.
Not the bad guy.
But I think that this also points to like Magi as being like just very fucking terrible people as an element of the system, which is also capitalism, as these Magi are literally capitalists in like the most direct sense. So the villain is clear. But yeah, it's an interesting spin on the whole idea.
For sure. Yeah.
I am very intrigued to see what plays out
with
the Bonds Magi in the future novels.
I'm going to be very enraptured in Red Country.
Yeah.
But as soon as we're done with Red Country,
you're starting I know.
No, but as soon as I'm done
in
with
a
like,
month,
the section that I'm
reading. Yeah. Red Skies.
I'm also reading the next one.
I'm very excited. I think there's a good chance that I'm going to read that as my next.
Once I'm done with the Devils also.
Yeah, there's that. Okay, hang on. So we got the Devils. We got Red Skies. Red Seas under Red Skies. We've got fucking Red Country. A lot of red in our future. This brings us to kind of our culminating moment of the show as our conversation goes, but also a crazy one. We see the culmination of the talents that we know to be Jean Tannen. And his backstory in interludes is probably, again, my favorite of the interludes. So many of them are so good, but like this just general portrayal, especially from Locke's perspective of like not understanding people's capabilities, outscaling what they appear as. And then in addition, like his formidable nature as the sort of monster of combat is just in and of itself very incredible. This leading to his fight with the sisters, which is brilliant.
His fight with the sisters
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Fair. His wicked sisters against the sisters, which I think he says sisters meet the wicked sisters meet the wicked sisters. And it's unclear who he's introducing to who.
Yeah, I think that's intentional. Yeah.
Fair. Yeah. It's very clever.
It's and we
effortlessly clever.
How intelligent Jean is. Here too.
Yeah.
Like he
did you doubt just, it?
No, of course not. Like we understood it and like that was well established from the jump. And then we get all of his combat training. Mm-hmm. And like but this is the showcase of everything.
Right.
It's such a fun combat scene.
Yeah. And it's so good. I mean it telegraphs so well, throwing the sisters, you know, like around variously, like dodging and the timing of it all. Oh my God.
Reading their movements and understanding the feigning, like their dual sort of dance that they do with the feigning of one into the attack of the other. And like him reading that really early on and understanding how it works.
Taking blows and then like readjusting to carve through the other person. So like taking one to like hit the other. You know, also just like great moments, him sliding them out and then becoming longer because he can use the rope as well. That's like tying them to his wrists. You know, like there's that whole kind of moment. Oh,
cinematic,
brilliant,
for sure.
Brilliant fight scene. Yeah. Incredibly well written. That brings us to the confrontation between Locke and the Grey King, which is like very much our end, you know, before like our denouement off into the sunset. Yeah. The confrontation with the Grey King. We, of course, get more information on the sisters being the siblings. We get sort of the villain monologue of exactly why Caparaza did what he did, given the sort of betrayal therein of his family and kind of coming back against them, the losses that they suffered, it's sort of very classical in a lot of ways, in a way that I didn't anticipate, you know, because I did expect sort of an undercutting from like it being the Thief Maker or it being Chains or something like that. So to have it be very normal was actually also an undercutting of actually,
that's true.
Which is so crazy.
Yeah. It's kind of funny.
Yeah.
God, it was so human so quickly. Like this larger than life character, and it's all just fucking revenge.
Yeah. This is best served cold from someone else's perspective.
Yeah.
Like that's all this is.
That's exactly what this is.
Yeah.
With a
lot more thieving.
Dress up
like that. But like, yeah, Gray King is, you know, his whole game is best of gold. And it's just so well done. And I really appreciate the novel for all that it did. The Gray King's death, I think, plays out well in and of itself. I do almost wish he lived. Because
yeah,
I think that
too.
He would have made like a better or like a good overarching villain, because I think that there was a lot there to consider. But I appreciate that it does feel, like you said earlier, like a self-contained standalone novel, which is also a good thing for it. So,
yeah,
I dig it. Yeah,
I will. Like, this is a book that I absolutely would not have probably picked up in other circumstances unless you pressed me to do so.
Sure.
And I am so fucking glad that I read it.
Yeah, same. This had been on my radar because it's so many people's favorite novel or like very adjacent, and like I've seen so much praise heaped upon it. It feels very similar to me to Name of the Wind in the way that like the series isn't finished, or Game of Thrones, but it's incredible and it's like worth it. And I was like, can any of those books be worth it? And I decided in the same month to start reading Name of the Wind and to read this. And this confirmed that yes, it can be. So, I mean, I could not give a shit about the sort of like lingering mystery of the fourth book. I will be excited when that book comes out, you know, in a decade. I don't assume it'll take that long, but like if it did, you know,
if it did,
I won't care.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sounds good.
Because that is how compelling this story is. So I am very glad that we read it. I'm very glad we got to talk about it. Is there anything else that you feel like we kind of skimmed over that you want to make mention of, or how do you feel?
I don't think so. I think we did a pretty good skip along job of hitting everything.
We were kind of all over the place. Yeah. I mean, I love the Gentleman Bastard series. I'm so excited to read the next one.
Me too.
All right. Well, with that, I'm not sure where this episode is going to release in the chronology of things. Chances are good. This is probably between a reading of Red Country and The Trouble with Peace, or sorry, A Little Hatred, I would imagine. It might be a little bit later than that. This is going to be an interstitial, but for our patrons, it's right now. So we appreciate your support. We hope that you loved this reading. And thank you so much for listening to our show.
For those of you who are not already within the folds of the Patreon, you can join us there at patreon.com/wordsandwhiskey. You can find us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook, and Reddit. No. Yeah. Words Whiskey Pod. On Reddit, too?
Words and Whiskey Pod on Reddit.
On Reddit.
This is old patter. I'm sorry. I fucked it up again. Oh,
it's all good. You can email us at wordsandwhiskeyshow@gmail.com. And I'm going to open up a different thing so I can find the phone number that I don't quite have memorized. I don't either, for the record. You can call us. Give me a shout
out
on my
phone
call.
Check out any other episode at the end to give us a phone call. Yeah, it's an exciting time. That said, also, please, for those of you of whom are listening to this later, obviously all of our lovely patrons already have, but if you haven't, leave us a review on whatever platform that you prefer. We are so excited for all that we have going on in the future and all that is to come. So I am amped and... Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool. I was also clicking around trying to find it while I was going through that. And we're in so the many folders like, within folders that...
Too many folders.
I can't
find it.
I did. Load. All right. Cool. The phone number, if you want to leave us a call or a text message, is 910-408-2534.
There we go.
So with that, we'll see you later.
Bye.
Bye.